Congressman Carlos Jimenez joins us to take your questions. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Republican Congressman Carlos Jimenez has been busy his first days in office, voting to decertify election results, against impeachment, and he's shown his opposition to Biden's immigration reform. The representative joins us to discuss his priorities for the first 100 days. Also, the pandemic has decreased the number of children in Florida going into the foster care system. A new report shows with fewer kids going into the system, the number of children facing abuse is on the rise. And finally,
we're going to create a contract. I'm going to have all you guys sign it, and you're going to rent out the equipment.
A look at how gyms are getting creative to keep the lights on during the pandemic. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. 10 Republican senators presented President Joe Biden with a $600 billion COVID relief package. Now, the proposal is significantly less than the $1.9 trillion that House Democrats are looking for, but the Biden administration seems open to some compromise. Meanwhile, millions of Floridians remain out of work, and tens of thousands each day are testing positive for COVID-19. When will Congress take action on relief? And what changes can we expect to other things like our country's immigration policies, this following the president's executive actions? Well, joining us now is Republican Congressman Carlos Jimenez, representing Miami-Dade and Monroe counties. Congressman, always a pleasure. Thank you.
It's a pleasure to be here again.
And by the way, if you have a question for the congressman on COVID, immigration, anything, give us a call, 800-743-9576. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Again, that's 800-743-9576. Congressman, I want to start with a relief package presented by the GOP. Substantially less than what Democrats are asking for, but is it substantial enough when you consider the economic challenges that small businesses, the municipalities here in South Florida are facing right now?
I'm not aware of the details of the $600 billion relief package. I know that there's a lot of money already left over from the previous relief package that can be reapportioned, which I think that's the first thing we ought to do. But I'm in favor of a $2,000 relief package to all Americans, qualifying Americans and families. I'm in favor of relief for businesses and small businesses in particular that have been suffering through this pandemic, especially with all these lockdowns that we see across the nation.
And when you say qualifying, what do you mean by qualifying? Who would qualify?
The qualifying individuals, I think it was $150,000 per household limit.
Okay.
So, you know, I have no problem with that. Although, you know, nothing is perfect in life. There are people making less than $150,000 that actually never lost their job. They kept right on working, so they really didn't have a pinch. A lot of government workers, none that I know of, lost their jobs. And so, but, you know, like I said, nothing is perfect. So you have to pick a starting point somewhere.
And you, when you were mayor of Miami-Dade, you were part of the team that oversaw millions of those relief dollars for local businesses, for the city governments. There's no funding. Looking at this, there's no funding included by this proposal for local governments. Do you think that's a mistake? Do you think that local governments should have the say in that?
No, local governments should get, you know, reimbursed for those expenses that are COVID-19 related. What I'm against is state and local governments relief on obligations, debt that were incurred prior to COVID-19. The COVID-19 had nothing to do with, and I think that's part of the problem that the GOP and we have with the president's proposal, is that there is also a bunch of stuff in there that has nothing to do with COVID-19. Hey, why don't we just leave it to COVID-19? Those businesses, those people that need relief from the effects of COVID-19, I think we're going to find bipartisan support. If you want to tack on some other stuff that really you're using COVID-19 as an excuse, I think that's a no-go for right now. First of all, $1.9 trillion is a heck of a lot of money. A lot of people, you know, we throw trillions and billions around, but if you were to put $1 trillion end on end, it would be 92 million miles. You go from here to the sun.
Okay. I mean, no, I got you. But when you say that about cities, I mean, you look at, for example, Miami. I mean, we've lost millions in tax revenue on tourism. Right now, this is when we would have so many visitors, and we're struggling. Businesses are going out of business. Shouldn't that?
No, I mean, look. The thing is businesses, okay? I'm okay with businesses. I'm okay with people. In terms of the cities themselves, all right, those cities, and I know there's lost revenue, but there's lost revenue everywhere, okay, in this country. And so that number would be astronomical, even further past the $1.9 trillion
in terms
of lost revenue. And so, look, at the end, this is an overdraft check. We don't have this money in the bank. We're going to borrow this money. We're going to borrow it from. We're going to borrow from China and other foreign countries. And then our children, and even our grandchildren are going to have to pay this back. Again, people, okay, individual people, homes, families, great. Okay, businesses that suffered, great. Even cities and states that you can say, hey, we've started this program in order to combat, you know, this COVID-19 pandemic. We help people, we fed people, all those things. I'm okay with. I'm not okay with debt, okay, that's accumulated from years past for programs, frankly, mismanaged cities and states. And why should the people of Florida and my district have to pay? Let's say Illinois is a great example. They're billions of dollars in debt in their pension system. Well, Florida is not billions of dollars in debt in their pension system. So why should we in Florida have to pay for the mismanagement of the people in Illinois? I don't think that's right. We're talking about COVID-19. Let's leave it at COVID-19. Don't bring a bunch of other stuff that's going to add, you know, $1 trillion to our debt for things that you may want to have simply by saying, oh, it's COVID-19. Right. It's got nothing to do with COVID-19. You're using COVID-19 as an excuse.
And again, just as I mentioned, the Republicans have their proposal. Biden has an idea for his proposal, or I should say the House Democrats do. Again, speaking with Republican Congressman Carlos Jimenez, representing Miami-Dade and Monroe counties, talking about COVID relief. We're going to be talking about as much as we can here today's conversation. If you have a question, you can call in 800-743-9576. If you can't get through, you can always post it on Facebook or Twitter. We'll try to get to some of those questions today. It's at WLRN Sundial. I want to transition to immigration. This is a hot button issue down here, of course, as you know. President Biden signed an executive order effectively ending construction on former President Trump's border wall. He also ended the ban on immigrants from majority Muslim countries and proposed, just a proposal, to establish an 8-year path to citizenship for millions of Americans. Let's tackle the first one, border wall. Only a fraction of the wall that President Trump promised is actually even sort of complete. But what do you want to see exactly with this?
I want to see border security. I mean, the first thing we got to do when we talk about immigration.
But,
immigration
does that reform, does that mean a wall?
It means whatever. Okay. It means that there are places where a wall is appropriate. There are places where a wall is not appropriate. Okay. In order to have border security, you can't, in order for us to talk about comprehensive immigration reform, you got to stop, you know, the problem of, you know, undocumented and illegal aliens crossing the border. You have to have border security.
I want to just ask about the wall, because this is what Biden stopped. He stopped the construction of the wall. Do you think a wall is successful at actually stopping immigration? Do you think we need one? And what do you mean by just in some places?
Like I just said, I think I answered that question. In certain places, the wall is appropriate. It's about the physical. Sometimes you have physical barriers. You don't need a wall. Sometimes technology can be better, you know, used to stop, you know, the illegal flow. And sometimes you have a physical barrier that you construct, which is like a wall. And so, look, I don't know where the wall is needed and where it's not needed. I do know, though, that I think that some of the wall money, the wall was already, the materials were already in place. The contracts were already in place. And so by doing what he did, you know, he cost, you know, thousands of people some jobs that were constructing the wall. And I'm not going to get into, hey, is the wall, should it be here? Should it be there? Because, you know, you got 2000 miles of it and I don't have the particulars of every single mile, but the overall concept is security and we need to secure our borders. And so, you know, that's what I'm in favor of. Whatever it takes to secure our borders. Is it a wall? Maybe not. Is it something else? Maybe. So, you know, whatever the experts say, yeah, this is what we need in this spot to secure the border. This is what we need in that spot to secure the border. That's what I'm in favor of.
What do you think of his proposal for the path to citizenship. You came out on Twitter against this.
No, I didn't. Actually, what I said, here's what I am, okay? I'm against a path to citizenship that guarantees that that citizenship to somebody who came in here not using legal means. What I would like to see is this, and I think a lot of people would agree with me. A, we need to establish a program to get people to come out of the shadows and give them an ability to work. 11 million people, 12 million people that are here that are undocumented, they need to come out of the shadows and a way to work, a way to pay taxes, et cetera. They're part of our society, and they're part of our society. There's also a practical impossibility to deport them. And so that's just reality. So let's start off with that. Then, but first you got to secure the wall. I mean, you got to secure the border, right?
All
right.
Secure
the border. You don't add to the problem. The people that are here, okay, you give them a way to come out of the shadows, to go ahead and work and work legally, et cetera. Now, in terms of citizenship, I believe that the way that the path should be that those people that are here, they don't have to physically leave the country, but they should get in line for the...
Well, what does that mean? Help me understand what it means to get in line, because don't you have to leave the country, apply, and wait until you get the opportunity to be able to come back in legally?
And that's what I say. I think that you can get in line in your country of origin without leaving the country, okay? And then if your number comes up, your number comes up, all right? And that's...
But then
and what that does is that those folks that in those countries of origins that were doing it the legal way...
And you have millions who didn't do it the legal way, so that means they'd have to leave and get in line.
No, listen, I guess you're not listening to me, okay?
I am. Right? Go ahead.
Yeah, okay. Because the laws can always be changed, all right?
Okay.
So you don't have to physically leave the country. You're staying here, but you get in line in your country of origin, all right?
Okay.
And then if your number comes up, it comes up. And if it doesn't come up, you know, during a lifetime, it didn't come up. And I think that most folks that are here undocumented are fine with that. I don't think that they're demanding citizenship. I think they want to come out of the shadows, and that's what we need to do. And then we also have to establish at the end some kind of an e-verify that says that, okay, now we've fixed the problem. We have an immigration system. The folks that are here are now out of the shadows. They can become citizens by getting, you know, back in line of their country of origin. And then now corporations, you know, you have to have an e-verify that says, okay, we got to stop the problem. So the reason they come here is for a better opportunity.
Yeah, no,
and
that's
the
true.
Fact that people are hiring them, okay?
Okay, so, what about this, though? Okay, because I understand what you're saying. But again, there are people who will say, hey, that person didn't come in legally the way I did. I want them to go back. But what about Cubans? What about Cubans that came here as well? Should they get in line?
Who?
Cubans.
The Cubans that came in here, they came in. The Cubans that came in here had, you know, a system that said wet foot, dry foot, et cetera. All right. And so that was the law at the time. Okay. If the law changed for Cubans, then the law changes for Cubans.
They don't have to reapply. Those people don't have to reapply.
Whatever system, look, whatever laws were in place on the time that they came. Okay. Those are the laws that you're complying with. All right. Except for the ones that are undocumented, that came in illegally, then, okay, we have to make accommodations for that. And we have to, you know, rectify the issue and face the fact we have 11, 12, 13 million undocumented immigrants in the country that are here. All right. They're part of our society. They do work. We need to bring them out of the shadows and do it in a way that as far as the citizenship aspect of it, doesn't put them, place them ahead of people that were trying to come in the right way.
And, okay? You know, I bring up Cubans because, you know, having lived here all your life, that other groups, Haitians, Salvadorians, Nicaraguans, Venezuelans will say that Cubans kind of, it was a double standard. The Cubans lived by a very different set of rules and got special treatment compared to other groups.
Yeah, they did. You know, and I'm sure that there are other, you know, groups that got the same or very similar treatment. Now, remember, you know, the issue with
nobody
Cuba
got treatment like Cubans. Nobody ever did.
Yeah. But also, look, the situation of the Cubans were a little different in that, you know, Cubans came here, you know, fleeing communism. All right. It was political in nature. All right. And that policy goes back, you know, a long time. And then, you know, actually doesn't go back even to when I came. When I came, I mean, we came. in a different way. And my parents had to leave the country. Again, we came for a visa. For all I understand, I was 6 years old, so I don't even know what how they got here. I know we got here through a visa. We came in on a plane, and then they had to leave the country and ask for permanent residency. So my parents and two other my uncles and another married, you know, family group got together in a station wagon, drove to Canada, drove to Toronto, and had to go to the Cuban, I guess, the American consulate there, get themselves a residency visa, and came back to the United States.
Again, talking with Republican Congressman Carlos Jimenez, and we're going to take your questions now. You can call in 800-743-9576. Covered COVID relief, immigration, lots to talk about. Let me go to the phones. I want to go to, I believe I have Claudine on the phone. Claudine in Miami, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
Good, good. What's your question?
So I have a question for Mr. Jimenez. For 4 years, we haven't heard a peep about, you know, financial conservatism, not a peep. And he was talking about, you know, where are we going to find the money for the $1.9 trillion help for the people? Maybe we can look into the same money that they found for the big tax cut during, you know, during the Trump era. Where did they find that money? So that was my question. Thank you.
All right. Congressman, Trump tax cuts have been something that Biden is looking at right now, again, looking to pay not just for his relief package, but the relief packages that we had throughout 2020. But to the question Claudine had about where are we going to pay for this? And, you know, do we have to go back towards the Trump tax cuts to look to see if perhaps that's where we can pull some of that money?
I think that increasing taxes at this point is about the worst thing that you could possibly do. We're coming out of a recession.
What about just for some people, like the wealthy?
Yeah, but listen, every time you say you're going to tax the wealthy at the end, it's always the poor people and middle class people that end up paying for it. You know, the corporate tax rate that was reduced allowed corporations to come back to the United States, allowed corporations to invest in the United States, allowed for the increase in the jobs that we saw during that time. When you start taxing folks and you say, well, just some people, you're never going to get enough out of those some people for all these programs that Mr. Biden wants to have. $1.9 trillion. I mean, again, people don't understand what that is. You know, the whole GDP, the entire production of the United States, everything that we do in goods and services is something over $20 trillion a year. You're talking about 10%. Of the entire production of the United States, that money that we don't have, and when they're, you know, the lady had talked about where's it been for 4 years. Look, as mayor, I've been a pretty fiscal conservative. I had, you know, I put through the largest tax cut in Miami-Dade County history and held the line on that tax cut throughout my entire time in Miami-Dade County. I was a pretty fiscal, you know, conservative, and I'm still a fiscal conservative. I'm looking at the future, our kids, our children, our grandchildren, and all this thing. Every time they talk about, well, let's tax, you know, that person over there, and let's not tax this person over here. At the end, we all pay for it. We'll pay for it because that person over there is supposed to be rich.
Right.
Probably has a business. Probably going to pass it on to us, and that's exactly what happens all the time. At the end, we end up paying for it. All of us end up paying for it.
I do want to mention, just to mention, that the Congressional Budget Office did project that Trump's tax cut would add $1.9 trillion to deficits over the next decade. Let me just to mention that. I want to move.
Right, so let's add another $1.9 trillion on top of that.
Okay, she wasn't talking about that.
So
she
was two wrongs don't make a right.
She wasn't talking about that. She was talking about, should we look at repealing possibly the tax cut, looking at other places where you'd find that money, not. She wasn't talking about the extra $1.9 trillion. Again, I'm just mentioning what the CBO said.
The problem is probably in just discretionary spending. You know, there is already, you know,
yes,
a big portion of the budget that's already set on, you know, entitlement programs, you know, so the discretionary part is a small portion of it. So now you're looking for the discretionary part. But what's the discretionary part? Most of it is in defense. Okay.
And no, so, I've seen the budget. Big, it's defense and it's healthcare. Absolutely. I know. I mean, I've seen the pie. Let me move to this. I wanted to ask you about the fact you came into Congress at a very challenging time. You had five Americans died in the siege in the Capitol. Now there's an investigation into the failure by Capitol Police, and pending, we have the pending impeachment trial that's coming up.
Right.
You voted against impeachment for the president. The president, people claim, incited the crowd. But what do you think? You don't think that we should go forward with this impeachment trial?
It may be unconstitutional, but I also think that the reason I voted against the impeachment of the president was it was a 3-hour impeachment. That's not American justice. You know, didn't go through committee. We didn't have any investigations. And now it's coming out that certain pipe bombs were already put there before the speech, the day before, that this was all organized on Facebook and other social media platforms by these radical elements that they were going there to cause problems.
But what about the fact that he was speaking to them hundreds of yards away before they attacked the Capitol? And again, what they're claiming is that the president incited the crowd to go forward and do it.
If you look actually what he said, go to the march on the Capitol and do it in a peaceful and respectful manner. He didn't say go and ransack the Capitol. And then there were already people there at the Capitol that weren't even at the speech, all right, that were there to do harm. Look, I personally saw one of these folks in my hotel lobby at 9 o'clock in the morning, already decked out in a helmet and pads, et cetera, and then said something to a couple of his compatriots there saying, hey, at 2 o'clock, we're going to storm. And my chief of staff thought, he said, the FBI. And so he called the Capitol Police and said, hey, there's people there going to cause problems, and got a call from the FBI. So this thing, a lot of these folks, the ones, the instigators, were there to cause problems beforehand.
If there was an investigation, would you support it?
Finally, okay. American justice. We don't, the reason that Nancy Pelosi said we had to impeach the president in the way that the president was impeached was because he was an imminent threat to the safety of the United States and we had to remove him from office. Well, that was impossible. He was never going to be removed before the 20th of January. That was political theater. If you really wanted to impeach a president, you ought to do it the right way, through committees, through testimony, and then have the president be able to defend himself. You don't do it in 3 hours. And that's exactly what happened at the Capitol.
Obviously, in the news right now, your colleague, House Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, under a lot of scrutiny for videos that have surfaced of her illustrating her history of spreading conspiracy theories, videos where she claimed that her belief in QAnon, also her attack on the folks in Parkland, calling it an inside job. There are calls for her removal. Do you think the Congresswoman is a threat to the House, to other people at the House? She threatened Nancy Pelosi's life. Should there be a vote to remove her?
Well, look, the issue of removing somebody from Congress is a very serious one, and I would be hesitant to put myself in place of the people from Georgia that elected her. Because I asked today, hey, how much of this stuff was already known by the time that her election came out? Apparently, most of it, if not all of it, was part of the campaign, and she got elected by the people of Georgia, okay? I'm hesitant to now say, I know better than the voters of the people of Georgia.
Let's look at this one. She threatened the life of Nancy Pelosi. If someone in the House said, you know what, Congressman Jimenez, we've got a noose ready for you. We're going to get this guy. Don't worry. Be patient. He's getting what's coming to him. Would you be fine with one of your colleagues threatening your life?
At this point, if that colleague was making those statements right now, okay, I would say I would have an issue.
Because she made those statements before she got into Congress?
Well, listen, a lot of people make a lot of statements and go, look, I'm not going to defend her, okay? I'm not here to defend her, all right? Because, I think a lot of the things that you've said, I disagree with 100%, all right? What I am saying, though, once you start to removing members from Congress, all right, that are duly elected by their people, that, you really need to have criminal activity, ethics complaints. That's what you remove people from Congress. When you start removing people from Congress for the things that they say, that's a very slippery slope. All right. So I'm really hesitant to do that, especially since the people of Georgia knew her and voted her in. It's up to the people of Georgia, I believe, at this point to take her out, unless we can demonstrate that she has she's been in some kind of criminal activity or unethical activity, unethical, you know, behavior as a member.
Is there at least going to be anybody looking to watch to make sure? Because look, here's the thing: as you said, with the attack on the Capitol, you had folks who were ready to round up. There were people who wanted to get Pence because Donald Trump called them a traitor and they wanted to hang him. These aren't folks that will just say bad things about you on Twitter. Some of these folks, we saw there was a group of people who wanted to kidnap a politician in Michigan. These are people who, when they're ready, they believe in something where they believe they are followers of a belief of God, that they are soldiers of God here to defeat the devil. And if you are part of that group, then they think you must die. And if they don't like you, they're going to find you and go after you. Do you not find that a threat? A person with that kind of belief that they wouldn't be a threat to you or somebody else, that's a person that maybe you don't want working with. If a coworker was threatening your life, even at any point, you don't want them removed?
Listen, again, I've been very, very clear. You keep on asking the same question, and I'm going to answer it the same way, all right? And so, you know, as far as I know, she hasn't threatened anybody during her time there in Congress. All right? Whatever she wrote before, some years back, and the people of Georgia elected her, all right, and put her there. It's going to be very hard for me to throw her out of Congress for things that were said so in the past, because that's a very slippery slope. In the future, then you can say, hey, somebody said this back, you know, 20 years ago on Twitter and made a comment, therefore they need to be removed from Congress. That's a very slippery slope. And if you don't understand that, okay, then there's a problem with you.
No.
Okay?
Well, that's an extremely
slippery slope.
All right? It is a slippery slope. It is. I agree with criminal, you, but I'm going to tell you something. I saw this in Nevada with a lawmaker threatening another lawmaker. They had to remove the guy. And the voters can decide.
Probably when the lawmaker was already there, but not something that was said in the past. Okay?
You know, still. Okay.
That's a very big. That's not a step.
Yes,
okay?
But that doesn't mean that person.
That's a very big difference.
And that person could still be a threat, is what I'm saying.
But everybody can listen. There are threats all around. You don't think that there are threats from the left and the right to every member of Congress? Of course there are. Okay.
From your own colleagues. You're getting threats from your own colleagues.
Look, if my colleague threatened a member of Congress now, I would be an issue. Okay.
Okay.
It would be an issue. Okay. Now, you know, that's where I stand, and I'm very hesitant. If they prove criminal or unethical behavior, I have no problem in dealing with a member of Congress or one of my colleagues. Okay. But when you talk about speech and what you say, that is that's very slippery slope. And you may not understand that, but I can also see what happens in the future. Obviously she's made some really, you know, far out statements, okay, that nobody agrees with, all right? But then the next one, well, it's not so far out. And then the next one, well, a lot of people disagree. Well, some people disagree. And then where does it stop? That's where I get to. That's where I find that this is a very slippery slope. And there are people that were calling for, you know, the 147 members of Congress that voted, you know, to not to certify Arizona. They all should be removed. Okay. So
yes, what? And you were one of them.
For a
you were one
of opinion, them. That's right. The problem. Okay.
And, all right. Well, that's.
That's the problem that I see. Okay.
We didn't get to that point. I'm going to stop there. You get the last word, as always. Republican Congressman Carlos Jimenez, representing Miami-Dade and Monroe counties. Always a pleasure, sir. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Stay safe. All right. Still to come. Fewer kids are entering foster care during the pandemic, and the number of kids placed for maltreatment went up. We spoke with researchers on the implications of their new study. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Fewer children are entering foster care during this pandemic, and the number of children being placed because of maltreatment has actually gone up. These numbers raise concerns for experts and children's advocates. Now, the findings are part of a study by the Florida International University and the University of Miami. We're joined now by Dr. Erica Musser, who worked on that study. She's an associate professor of psychology at FIU, as well as a licensed clinical psychologist here in Florida. Dr. Musser, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you so much for having me.
And also Robert Latham, he's the associate director of the Children and Youth Law Clinic and lecturer in law at the University of Miami. He also co-authored this report. Mr. Latham, thank you so much for your time, sir.
It's great to be here.
Beyond the data, I'm wondering, have you spoken with children and families in the foster care system to get a sense of what's been going on over this past year since the pandemic started? Dr. Marshall, I'll start with you.
Currently, my work clinically does not work directly with youth in the foster care system. And the research that we did for this particular study was based in archival data, so data that's publicly available through the Department of Children and Families. I know that Robert works more directly with foster youth and families right now than I do, so he may have more information.
Mr. Latham, I mean, I'd love to hear if you've heard stories or if you've been hearing from folks about what they've experienced and what's going on.
Absolutely. So our clinic works with foster kids and young adults who have aged out of foster care. And there's one thing that's true about the foster care system. It is that whatever's going on in greater society happens to the foster care system 100 times stronger. So the foster care system, especially at the beginning, really struggled with resources, really struggled with getting kids access to education, getting kids access to medical care, dental care, and all the things that every other family in our community is struggling with. We have done better over time. The system has really worked hard to figure it out, I guess you could say, but those struggles still remain.
And those struggles, I mean, that's even before the pandemic. What did the pandemic do?
Well, a separate study that I did with another colleague, Keely Stewart, really showed that the pandemic slowed the foster care system down. So the foster care system is supposed to be temporary. So foster homes take in kids, and those kids then go back to their parents or are adopted eventually. So it relies on kind of a pipeline of spaces to open up. The pandemic slowed that pipeline down. So kids weren't exiting as quickly. So there was a lot of concern, especially at the beginning, about whether we would have the resources to work with families. So for example, the pandemic reduced the reliance that we have on using group homes, because there was a lot of concern, rightful concern, about placing kids into group homes with a large number of other kids.
Yeah.
The pandemic reduced the number of foster kids that are currently placed in correctional settings. So fewer kids were arrested during this time because people in the foster care system were worried about referring them out to those large group home or group settings like that.
Yeah. So again, because of the fear of the spread, there were a lot of things that just couldn't be done. And of course, that means you've got kids kind of left in a weird, maybe even dangerous kind of limbo. But Dr. Musser, I gave a very brief description at the beginning of what's going on. Help me just understand better, explain to me what this report really says.
Sure. So as I mentioned, we had archival data available through the Department of Children and Families here for the entire foster care system in the state of Florida, dating back to January of 2000 up and through June of 2020. So this was data for over 300,000 youth within the foster care system. And we were really focused in particular on April of 2020, which was the duration of the Safer at Home order put in place by the governor. And using this data, we demonstrated that there was a significant decrease in the number of youth placed in the Florida foster care system during the COVID-19 pandemic, with the greatest reduction being seen in April of 2020. So if you compare the number of youth placed in April of 2020 to the year prior, April 2019, there were about 24% fewer youth placed in foster care during April of 2020. And the percentage of placements into foster care that were due to maltreatment were found to increase by approximately 3.3%.
Does the data tell us why? Can we just figure why?
Yeah, so we can't really say why there's a change in the percent placed or the percent placed due to maltreatment. There are a number of reasons that may be at play here. Some of those being, more sort of institutional or systemic, and some of those being, you know, a little more personal.
And Mr. Latham, I'm just curious what you think as to why we see that increase in the maltreatment.
Well, the foster care system, so one thing to know is that, you know, nationally there's over 4 million calls to state hotlines, but only about 4% of those ever result in the removal of a child and placement in foster care. So the pandemic greatly reduced the number of calls, but we're still working through the data to determine which calls didn't get made. Were they the lower risk calls that really could have been handled with a referral to social services or therapy? Or were they the higher risk calls of kids that were at imminent risk of physical or sexual abuse? So the future study is going to have to sort out, you know, how much of the reduction we saw was based on changes in the community around maltreatment and how much of it was based on changes at the Department of Children and Families on what they prioritized.
By the way, is anybody else around the country also doing similar research? Have they looked in to see what the past year or even specific months during the height of the pandemic, what that showed? Dr. Musser, did you see anything else like that nationally?
So I did a large literature review on the role that COVID-19 may have played with respect to child maltreatment and child welfare. And what we really found were there were four empirical published studies prior to ours, but those studies were specifically looking at reports of suspected maltreatment to a child protective services hotlines in different states or different cities, different communities. So this is one of the first studies that, to my knowledge, looked at cases of substantiated child maltreatment and youth entering the foster care system specifically.
And Dr. Musser, I mean, you know, thinking about the state officials or even politicians, has anybody responded to this report? You know, has anybody said anything about it or that maybe even surprised you?
Not yet. We haven't had anybody involved in policy shaping or the like reach out yet, but I am hoping that this data may influence policy in the future, or at least, you know, increase or contribute to the conversation about what's going on for these kids and the way that we can, you know, improve overall the child welfare system in, you know, the face of future global crises, because I anticipate that, you know, the COVID-19 pandemic isn't the last global crisis that I'll see even in my lifetime.
Again, I'm talking with Dr. Erica Musser, an associate professor of psychology at FIU and a licensed clinical psychologist here in Florida. We're also talking with Robert Latham, professor at the University of Miami's School of Law. Now, they worked on a recent study about, again, how the pandemic has affected the foster care system in Florida and children who face abuse and neglect. And again, the numbers that we saw, as Dr. Musser pointed out, you know, fewer people getting into the system, but we see that the number of people getting in because of this maltreatment is going up, and trying to understand what the data is telling us. By the way, if you in any way have seen anything, you're probably in some way part of the foster care system, whether as a parent, a child, or a worker, and there's something that we are not talking about, there's something happening that we should be looking into, always email us, sundial@wlrnnews.org. Again, sundial@wlrnnews.org. Mr. Latham, people who normally report suspected abuse tend to be like healthcare workers and teachers. But because of the pandemic, we had a lot of kids at home, so they weren't there to see what was really happening. How much do you think that's had an impact on the problems that kids have been facing?
That's a great question. There has been a lot of public discussion around that question. So teachers are the single the profession that makes the most number of reports, but they're not actually the largest percentage of reporters. Law enforcement is. Police officers who respond to scenes and don't make an arrest, but do call in social services to help. So teachers make up about 20% of the calls to the abuse hotline each year. And the reductions we saw really do kind of match up with those numbers, including in our data showed that the number of children aged 0 to 3 that came into the foster care system went up comparatively, meaning the school-aged children were less representative in that removal group. But a lot of people are worried that, you know, that kids aren't being seen, that kids might be somehow less safe. And I want to respond to that by saying, you know, people need help right now. And so if you do see something or suspect something, reach out to your neighbor and ask them what it is they need. The foster care system is an extreme response. And sometimes people really just need a little help.
And that's interesting. Yeah, Dr. Musser, please go ahead.
I was just going to piggyback on that as well and say, you know, there are, as Robert said, this is a very difficult time. As a clinical psychologist, I see a lot of families who are struggling, who have a lot of stressors in their lives right now, more so than probably any other time in my professional experience. And I just want parents to realize that they're not alone in this. There are a lot of parents who are struggling right now with stress and lack of resources and support, and it's okay to ask for help. And there are lots of supports available for families who are struggling. So for example, at FIU, we have the Center for Children and Families. There are a large number of programs there that are free or available at a low cost, no cost, to families who need extra help with parenting support, child behavior problems, and even parental mental health concerns or parental struggles or stresses.
But as a clinical psychologist, have you seen people come forward, you know, and admit, listen, yeah, this pandemic has taken a toll on me. The economy has taken a toll on me. Are they reaching out, asking for help, looking for help?
Absolutely. The number of calls that we have seen in the center have increased substantially. And I know that that's not just our center. I have a number of colleagues in the field nationally, really, who are talking about the increased concerns related to parental stress, as well as to parental mental health and mental health more generally, is a concern right now. The pandemic has really taken a toll, I think, on overall well-being for a lot of people, including parents.
And we looked at this, you know, early on in the pandemic. Is there a correlation right now between those stressors and child abuse? And can we say definitively that there is, or we don't know yet?
I think that prior research has really supported a link between parental stress, parental mental health concerns, parental substance use and abuse, those types of things in child maltreatment. Of course, it's not a one-to-one correspondence such that everyone experiencing one or more of those things is at risk for engaging in child maltreatment, but there is an association. The data that was available in this study isn't able to look at that directly, but prior work has certainly shown an association between those factors.
Mr. Latham, you talked about young children compared to, you know, school-aged children. I'm wondering, did this report give us any sense of, you know, the issues between race, ethnicity as well? Do we have a sense of how different groups are affected by this?
It does, yes. So the three main forms of maltreatment that the child welfare system looks at is abuse, abandonment, and neglect. That third category of neglect really correlates strongly with poverty. And unfortunately, as we know in our world, poverty also correlates strongly with race. And so there has been a history in the child welfare system of disproportionately removing Black children from their families and placing them into foster care. And then once Black children get into the foster care system, they stay longer and have a harder time exiting on the other end. So this the data that we saw actually showed, a disproportionality around the foster care system kind of prioritizing younger children, children that had experienced substance abuse or domestic violence maltreatments, and white children. So interestingly, the study showed that the foster care system removed fewer Black children proportionately during this time. And again, that could be, that's not a good thing if those children needed help. And so we really have to sort out whether those children were being over-removed before the pandemic, or now we have under-removed kids that could have been helped.
And of course, we continue to fight the pandemic, not sure how much longer it's going to take. I want to thank my guest, Dr. Erica Musser, Associate Professor of Psychology at FIU, again, also a licensed clinical psychologist here in Florida, Robert Latham, Professor at the University of Miami School of Law. Again, they both worked on a recent study about the effects of the pandemic on the foster care system. You could check out more on our social media at WLR and Sundial. Dr. Musser, Mr. Latham, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, still to come, don't feel comfortable going to the gym? Well, what if you could rent the equipment? Gym owners are getting creative during COVID. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Daniel Marks owns two private gyms, one in Plantation and another one in Pembroke Pines. The pandemic forced him to stop in-person training sessions, and he came up with an unusual way to stay in business. Now, this story comes to us from NPR's Next Generation Radio. That's a workshop for new journalists. And their most recent project looks at different ways that COVID-19 has affected the lives of Floridians. Former WLRN intern Amber Amortegui interviewed Marks about how his business had to adjust for the times.
Hi, my name is Daniel Marks, and I'm owner of Exclusive Performance in South Florida. When the pandemic hit, I immediately contacted all my clients and explained to them, listen, every business is shutting down, including gyms, which is what I own. I own a private facility. We didn't know how long it was going to be, so I said, listen, we're going to create a contract. I'm going to have all you guys sign it, and you're going to rent out the equipment. The moment you rent out the equipment, it's your responsibility. If you know anything about commercial gym equipment, things can range anywhere from $100 to about $10,000 or $12,000 per piece of equipment. I also took a big risk having, you know, $5,000 walk out of the facility, $10,000 walking out of the facility, and potentially not returning. I'm also big on mental health for them. So for them being able to train in a community aspect or a community forum, you know, via video conferencing, and we have platforms like FaceTime for iPhone and WhatsApp and now Zoom and a few other platforms. So I just decided to move it all online over video and make sure that, you know, my clients still got a person face-to-face movement. It wasn't something that I would enjoy doing because I'm more of a hands-on person-to-person. I need to see what's going on in order to be able to make the adjustment and get you moving in an optimal way. For about the first week or two, people were very skeptic because, hey, you know, my house is dirty, or don't mind my dogs. I'm training and here comes my dog or cat running across the screen. I saw them become even more of a family. Some people don't have immediate family inside their house, so it was definitely a challenge for them. But seeing, you know, 10 or 15 people that they would normally see out at the gym was definitely a relief for them. We did this 6 days a week for almost 2 months. But I don't want this to go too long because I want them to return to a place that they miss. When we were first told that we could actually open our businesses back up, we had to follow, you know, specific guidelines and everything. I contacted them again and said, listen, we have 24 hours for all of you guys to return the equipment. So please bring it back, get it back here immediately, or you're going to be charged for the amount of equipment that has left the facility. A handful of people were a little bit skeptical about returning to being around people. We had to be careful with, you know, wearing masks and not touching things that other people are touching, making sure that our, you know, facility is extra clean, more clean than it already is, more sanitized than it already is. All of the weightlifters go by and literally, shh, and I wipe down everything. It was nice when they all came back, they brought back all the equipment, and that moment of relief, wow, I'm still able to do my livelihood, and wow, everyone's still coming back. What I've learned from, you know, not only being in a pandemic, but having my business potentially close unannounced, I would have to say perseverance. During tough times, people do come together. People are willing to sacrifice being at home and training and working out with my own equipment. It goes to show you that there are still good people out there that, you know, you can lend something to and they can bring it back undamaged. And I know if you're going to do that, then we're pretty much coach and athlete or trainer and client for life.
That was Daniel Marks. He owns two private gyms in South Florida, and he was interviewed by Amber Amortegui for Next Generation Radio, an NPR program hosted recently by WUSF Public Media. You can find an illustration and this story on our social media at WLRN Sundial or at WLRN.org. Well, that's our program for today, this Monday, February 1st. Happy February. We're going to get an update on Governor DeSantis' proposed budget and the priorities for the legislature tomorrow on the show, plus a look at how culture and nutrition can intersect. We have a panel conversation with a nutritionist and an entrepreneur in the raw food world, and we'll learn more about that intersection. All of that coming up tomorrow on the show. Also, 10 years of Miami's art scene told through the new photo book, Miami Creative. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks again for listening. As always, stay safe, be good to each other. We'll talk to you live tomorrow.